I thought we'd start off with some rocking music, something blast from the past, if you will. That was the Wooden Heart Polka, and that's a special call out to all those people that are ironically wishing the Texans all that they've repped by voting for Mr. Trump. Frankly, it's going to be such a disaster there for so long. I wouldn't certainly wish that on anyone. We've lived through some pretty bad hurricanes ourselves here in Florida, and certainly having gone through that, I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And when you combine that with the amount of flooding they've had, that kind of double threat is really going to have a long-term impact. And then, unfortunately, Texas has one other really, really critical factor involved. You know, the Texans, with their Republican leadership there, has basically ignored any kind of environmental issue. They've ignored environmental quality. They basically built factories and refineries and chemical plants in the middle of neighborhoods. Of course, you know what kind of neighborhoods we're talking about, disadvantaged, economically stressed, lower working class neighborhoods, where literally the chemistry is going to be impacting those people for a long time. And it's bad enough when it's contained in the factory, just venting with plumes of smoke and the runoff, but they've been flooded. And those toxic chemicals are in their homes, on their streets, in their yards, in their gardens. And it's going to have an impact for a very, very long time. And in fact, I've heard the argument made that literally this is going to give a toxic impact to Texans for decades and decades to come. You know, we have not heard the last of that news, that's for sure. And in just a minute or two, we're going to be hearing from our good friend Brooke Hines, who's got her report for the DNC trial. I'm sure many of you are aware that Democratic Party was basically sued because they did not act with what they told us was an even hand. Now, we've all been told, those of us who are Democrats were told for years, that the primaries determine who gets the vote. But what we found out was that as far as the Democratic Party is concerned, they can put in charge and they can put in the driver's seat anybody they want. And it has nothing to do with who voted, it has nothing to do with who's donated. They can do it any way they want. They say they're a private club. And basically, they don't even have to behave according to their own rules. And there was a case that was at trial for some time. And the first trial basically came to an end when the judge, for some strange reason, said that the plaintiffs had no standing. I would argue, and I'm sure the lawyers argued, that anybody who donated to the Democratic Party or was a Democratic Party member, they have every reason to have standing. But that's a matter for the courts, and unfortunately they ruled against us. I do do also want to mention that our good friends, Mr. Lee Tiger, has got his CD party coming up on the 7th. And he's invited us to get the word out that if you go to Miccosukee Seminole Hard Rock Cafe on the night of the 7th, the band starts at 9. So come on down there. He's having a CD release party. He's been rocking since he was 14 years old. He's had his own band. So I would urge you to try to support Mr. Lee Tiger and his new CD release. We're going to try to make it down there ourselves. And Brooke should be with us in a minute. Let me go ahead and remind you that we have good friends also at the Daughters of Isis. So let's hear their promotional piece, the Daughters of Isis.
Daughters of Isis is the ancestor of aromacology, indigenous scents representing the fragrant memories of our ancestors, to provide us the tools of the inner quest, the authentic moment, and to heal the Earth Mother. daughtersofisis.com. Wholesale available also. Mention PNN and enjoy a free sample from our apothecary. For your aromatherapy needs, that's daughtersofisis.com.
Okay. Well, while we're waiting for Brooke to make the connection, let's go ahead and play this piece from Mother Jones. interestingly enough, our good friend Marilyn Evans is starting Mother Jones organizations again up in West Virginia to bring help to the good people there who have been treated so badly by the extraction industries in West Virginia. But here from the recordings of Joanne Foreman is the unsung hero Mother Jones.
For this I came from Ireland, Mary Harris Jones might have said. She was 37 in 1867, and her husband and all four children lay dead from yellow fever. Moving to Chicago from Memphis, she set up a dressmaking business. She wrote in her autobiography, "Often while sewing for the lords and barons who lived in magnificent houses on Lakeshore Drive, I would see poor shivering wretches, jobless and hungry, walking along the frozen lakefront. Summers I watched mothers from the slums, lugging babies and little children, hoping for a breath of fresh air from the lake." This compassion and acuteness led Mary Harris Jones to the Knights of Labor, to the IWW, and to virtually every struggle of working people, particularly miners who had the most dangerous job next to farm workers. Sweet-faced, impeccably clad in widow's black, with a touch of white lace at the throat, she was not afraid of the devil. At a time when few women traveled alone, she crisscrossed the nation, her possessions tied up in a black shawl. "I like to travel light," she said. One time, when confined by the police in a dark basement during a Colorado mining strike, she passed the time fending off rats with her shoe. Another time in Pennsylvania, she was confronted by anti-union thugs. She whipped out from under her crisp little gingham apron a .38 special and invited them to withdraw. They did. Hauled up before a judge in West Virginia, she called him a scab to his face. Told she must say, "Your Honor," she retorted, "Well, I can't call him Your Honor until I know how honorable he is." In Alabama, she slipped past a military sentry, explaining that she was going to a missionary meeting to knit mittens for the heathen of Africa. A sense of humor was one of Mother Jones' most powerful tools. When she was a mere 73, she organized a massive march of children to New York City. Accused of exploiting them, she pointed out that they labored 10 and 12 hours a day in mines, fields, and factories. This led to the raising of the legal working age to 14. At 89, she participated in the Great Steel Strike of 1919. "Mother is here," was the cry, particularly among the women. Mother Jones knew that no struggle could be won unless the women were behind it. She lived to be 100, but one hopes her spirit lives on. Tune in next time for the life of Fanny Sellins. Songs for the Unsung is a project of user-friendly music, script, narrative, and original music by Joanne Foreman, sung by Jenny Bird.
Here's a song for the unsung working women who worked for America. Here's a song for the unsung.
Okay, that was Joanne Foreman's Songs of the Unsung. And now it's here she is herself, the nitty gritty girl herself, on this special report from Progressive News Network. Brooke, welcome.
Hey there.
How you doing, my friend?
I am well. It's good to talk to you. Not on a Sunday.
That's right.
And I understand we have a big show on Sunday with the round table. So
it's going to be a blast.
We thought we might do this update on the DNC fraud lawsuit before then. And for our listeners who have not heard, the Southern District Court of Florida dismissed the DNC fraud lawsuit Friday, which was the same day that President Donald Trump pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and was also the day that we were also watching Hurricane Harvey. So there was a lot of things going on, and the DNC fraud lawsuit has gotten the short shrift. You know, it's gotten a little bit lost in the mix because there's just been so much going on. Oh, and also Sebastian Gorka took leave of the White House. There's just a ton of news. And also, to report properly on the dismissal of the DNC fraud lawsuit takes a lot of time to go through the judge's order, which is 28 pages. And let me tell you, a 28-page dismissal is significant, and that in itself tells you something about what the judge is thinking in terms of the dismissal. But the first thing I thought I would tell the listeners is that we've been seeing a lot of really quick hot takes on the dismissal. And in these hot takes, We've been seeing writers claim something that sounds like this. Well, the judge agreed that the DNC treated Sanders unfairly, and that there was inequality in the way that the two candidates were treated during the primary and this, that, and the other. The judge, in fact, did not say that. There's a term of art in these pleadings and in these dismissals, and there's a theory called the four corners of a complaint. And what the judge is trying to do when he says in the complaint that that he is going to accept that everything that the plaintiffs argued was well pled, he is saying that given that everything that the plaintiffs say is true, given that everything that the plaintiffs say is true and 100% true and well pled, given that, then I am giving my opinion. So it's a way of saying, it's a way of setting up an if-then statement. If this is true, then I'm saying this. Now, that doesn't mean that Judge Block was saying that there was anything wrong with the way that the plaintiffs put forth their argument. As a matter of fact, he went out of his way to say that the arguments that the plaintiffs put forward were in fact well pled, and that is significant because he didn't have to say that. So he said that the arguments were well pled. That's significant. The lawsuit was dismissed on the grounds of subject matter jurisdiction, which is basically standing, and this is what we've been talking about all along, and where a lot of journalists have been focusing on in terms of their speculation as to whether or not the lawsuit would go forward or not. This was the key element of the motion to dismiss from the defense, from the DNC. Is there subject matter jurisdiction for donors to claim that they've been defrauded when they've given money to a political party in a primary process? Now, here's the interesting thing. Judge Locke, in this 28-page order to dismissal, and it's called a final order of dismissal. It was not the prejudice. It's a final order of dismissal. He opens the door for an appeal. And as a matter of fact, there are parts within this dismissal where the question of appeal is essentially begged. And what Locke is saying is that he doesn't have the ability to define the subject matter. He doesn't have the ability to define the donors as having standing, and that definition exists just outside of his ability, his jurisdiction to define that. And in order to get that definition, you have to go to the higher court. You have to go to the 11th Circuit, the next step up in an appeals process, and get that definition. So here's the interesting thing. As of Friday, the plaintiffs had 30 days to decide whether or not they want to file an appeal. So the clock is ticking. It's 7 days have passed. I'm sure that they have been discussing this amongst all of the counsel involved. It's not just Beck and Lee. It's their associated counsel. They have, I think, as a lot of people know, have put a tremendous amount of time and money into the first part of this lawsuit and have felt at times threatened, you know, with the robot phone call and mysterious deaths, you know, tangential to this case and also material to this case. And so they have a lot to chew on. They have a lot to think about. But in every instance where I have seen either Elizabeth or Jared back talking about the potential for them to do an appeal, they're not dismissing the idea. As a matter of fact, they seem as if it's something that is on the table. In fact, they've said it's on the table. And to that, I wanted to suggest to our listeners trying to find the website. It is, I believe it's jampack.org. If you want to help, the to move on in their case, it would probably be very appreciated. They would probably appreciate it very much if you visited their website at jampack.us. That's JAMPAC, J-A-M-P-A-C, like Political Action Committee, JAMPAC.us, and make a little contribution to help them defray some costs. That's going to help them take this to appeals. They now have 21 days to make that decision, and it does seem to me like they are leaning in that direction, and it does seem to me like a piece of law. This is a piece of law that needs to be decided. This is a definition that needs to be determined. Judge Locke was very keen on this in the order to dismiss or in the dismissal, and you can. It jumps off of the pages that. That this particular judge would like to see this go forward and just can't without that definition. And again, that definition is the subject matter standing. So do donors to political parties in the primary process, do they have standing based on fraudulent representations and or omissions? You know, to come back and say, you know, we were defrauded and we would have been happy if this process had gone forward in an equitable manner, but it didn't go forward in an equitable manner. This was like a rigged horse race. So that's the definition. It's very clear cut what stands before the Becks, what the next steps are, and what their path forward could and should be. The question really just is, will they step forward and will they take that step forward, or possibly could another law firm step forward, or maybe they could team up with other people. Who knows what's going to happen? But there's 21 more days for us to find out.
Well, you know, Brooke, I got to say, the voices from the Democratic Party crying out for fairness, crying out for even-handedness, crying out for a truly responsive Democratic leadership have been, AWOL.
Yeah, they would rather not talk about this. That is for sure. And let's flip it around as well. I don't want to inflate this too much, but you know, this case dealt with errors and omissions, misrepresentations and omissions having to do with the 2016 presidential primaries and the presidential election. We are now looking at what's the midterms for 2018, and we're already seeing candidates get in place like Kamala Harris for 2020 presidential run. it's my opinion that we're never going to see another person, another character such as Debbie Wasserman Schultz leading the DNC. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the brazen manner in which the DNC was run under Debbie Wasserman Schultz's watch cannot happen again. Now, what that means, I believe, is that it doesn't mean that they're going to completely clean up their act. It just means that they're going to get better at, you know, getting what they want and making sure that everyone else is pushed out of the process. As it stands now, people who are watching Bernie Sanders and people who are watching Kamala Harris, Sanders is not backing away from a 2020 run. And Kamala Harris is definitely sprinting towards a 2020 run. You know, she's running ads on Twitter, you know, promoted posts of, I support Medicare for all. And this comes, what, a week after it was leaked that the DCCC, was telling their candidates to lie and tell constituents and tell voters that they support Medicare for all, just to push out the progressives in the primary process and then, you know, of course, go back on your promise once you're elected, because nobody in their right mind would support Medicare for all, wah, 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 wah. You know, a week after that came to light, for Kamala Harris to come out with, oh, I'm for Medicare for all, seems incredibly disingenuous. And, you know, we need to see a lot more than just, you know, I'm for it. You know, she's going to co-sponsor the bill. Let's see some real fighting for it. Let's see some real political capital spent on it. But in terms of 2020, I think that Sanders is positioning himself for a run, which means we are going to see the possibility of another ugly fight again, which is going to put the DNC in the hot seat. So it behooves us to make sure that things are fixed with regard to the DNC. And I'll tell you this, too. There's a lot of chatter. There's a lot of people saying that and a lot of anger with regard to whether or not people should even support Democrats and support the party or support people who are running under the Democratic banner, period, after everything that happened in 2016. Like, there is that much animosity. And, you know, as somebody who grew up as an FDR Democrat and as a, you know, in a Kennedy-worshipping household, that is almost unthinkable to me. But the other half of my family, you know, under my roof, is very much interested in seeing a third party or an independent runs and, you know, all of that sort of thing. And so, you know, I believe that I'm becoming the minority voice. I believe that progressives who think that the party is able to be reformed, we're becoming the minority voice because so many people are leaving the party, just period. They're just saying, I've had it, no more, you know, this is an abusive relationship. We're going to go do something else, and you guys can, you know, just carry on with your neoliberal bad selves, you know.
Yeah, I have to admit, when you said the Democratic Party will be fixed, my
right.
First inclination was to say, gee, I think it already was fixed.
Right.
With a predetermined preferred outcome. Let me ask you a question. You know, Brooke, since it really looks like, as far as party leadership is concerned, what they see as their route to election is more of the same, shadowing the Republicans, with the only criticism of Republicans being, They're crazy, we're not, so therefore we're better, even though our policies are essentially, any differences are shades rather than, you know, clearly clear cut. And while on the one hand, they'll have Bernie out there in front saying, yay, look at Bernie. But on the other hand, you know, there's not even lip service to the agenda that Senator Sanders has been pushing for 30 plus years. You know, they obviously don't think of much of the electorate and don't think that they're worth even pretending to convince. I mean, I honestly think they've walked away and they're just hoping that that they can fool the people the same way the Trump people are. And there's this one big lump and mass available to any fool who'll promise them the sky.
Well, it's, you're absolutely correct on all counts there. And I think that for a good many progressive Democrats, it is inconceivable to imagine that there would be people within our party who are against Medicare for All or who are against tuition-free college. But when you get out there and you start really taking stock of what people are saying in social media, and I'm not just talking about rank and file people, I'm talking about leadership. There are powerful moneyed forces at work that do not want to see any kind of change that would benefit people in the manner of Medicare for All, that would lift people up out of the morass of medical bankruptcies or you know, a peonage to the university system. You know, I just heard a thing. I'm a real big fan of podcasts, and podcasting is something that I obviously like to do myself. Matt Taibbi and Alex Perrine have a podcast called the Tarfu Report, which I urge everyone to check out. And the episode that just dropped today was included a fantastic discussion of the amount of money that universities have been socking away for in secret for the last, say, 10 years. They have had this incredible savings account, and it only came to light by accident from a provost from University of Wisconsin, I believe, just tangentially as a matter of discussing something else. But it turns out that universities have been socking away billions of dollars because they've been raising tuition so freaking high, and the student loan economy makes it so that students can automatically go into debt and have as much debt as they possibly want to. So as much as the universities determine they want to charge, those students have no choice but to, you know, put that number down on their student loan form. So essentially what's happened is all of these university systems that are sitting on billions and billions of dollars worth of cash, that's being funded by the futures of our children. You know, if I'm old enough to have college-age children, and, you know, you look around and, you know, all the millennials around us who are, you know, can't find affordable housing, can't find jobs, and have huge student loans, they are in debt peonage to universities that weren't using their money to make ends meet, weren't using their money to pay professors. They were using their money to hoard their money. It's a wealth transfer, and it's a wealth transfer on the backs of people who are going in debt to do it. And it's obscene. It shouldn't be allowed. But instead of not being allowed, instead of the consumer being protected, the consumer is being held out by our party members we're being held out there, you know, in order for those guys to flee. And there's precious few people in our party who are willing to fight for us. You know, you've got a couple of Russ Feingolds, you've got a couple of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But beyond that, you know, who really is you know, willing to go to bat against, you know, the vast oligarchy conspiracy, you know, because that's really what we are up against. And when we send, you know, our little congressmen to Washington, you know, from Polk County or Volusia County or wherever, they're just going there to play the game and get what they can for themselves. They're not going there to do the work of the people. And that's what they used to do, you know. And something changed along the way. And I think it's about time that something drastic changed on our side to change that. And, you know, as much of a loyal Democrat as I am, and I have been all my life, and it's in my family, and it's in my DNA, I'm willing to try anything, because we can't stay on this trajectory. We've already leveraged the future of a whole generation. What more are they going to ask from us?
You know, one of the things that strikes me particularly right now is that, you know, we have heard from the Republicans their sermon on big government. We've heard their sermon that our concern about the planet, our concern about environmental regulation is extraneous to the lives of the real people, the corporations, and that in every way hinders and in no way helps. I think that's being put to the acid test right now in Texas. And all those communities that are currently being bathed in a toxic wash, you know, besides the fact that they're obviously the profoundly poor, but larger and larger communities are going to be impacted by this toxic stew that was the big Texas flood. And, you know, we're going to find out, are people really prepared to basically be collateral damage in this rush to end regulation? And I think it's a, you know, real put up or shut up kind of time. And if the Republicans and that freebooter capitalism at all costs mentality wins the day, Texas isn't going to be habitable. And it's a harbinger of things to come.
Well, we talked about that on Sunday to a certain extent. The floodwaters are still such that we don't have a good assessment of what's going on in the Barrier Island, the Galveston area, in the Barrier Island region, where there is a ton of critical industrial infrastructure. And yesterday we saw the explosion of a chemical plant, which prompted a lot of reporting, and I urge people to seek out David Sirota at International Business Times, IBT. He was on Democracy Now! This morning. He's been doing some fantastic reporting on how the GOP in Texas worked with the EPA on the federal level to remove the regulations from chemical plants that, you know, would have prevented that particular explosion. So that's just one chemical plant, one explosion, one example that just came to light. There are hundreds of such businesses in that region that we haven't heard of yet, and that's not to mention the biological research corridor down there. You know, Galveston, Texas is the home to one of the highest level security facilities that houses, you know, not to raise anyone's alarm, but it's where the country keeps like all of our worst germs and diseases for research and in all different areas, whether it's biological warfare, this and that. So, you know, people who are, who, you know, have been waiting for the zombie apocalypse, this could be it, you know, when the, this particular facility in Galveston, by the way, the level, there's 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so level 4 is the level that where the most critical germs and diseases and, you know, tissues and stuff are held. That level happens to be on the lowest level of the building.
Where, oh my God!
So, the most vulnerable towards, and you know, don't let it get lost too that this facility itself is sited on a barrier island. You know, on the level of Fukushima, you know, the nuclear plant being, you know, right on the ocean, you know, like right in the way of any kind of typhoon or tsunami event. You really couldn't site that facility in a less secure location, unless it was maybe on Key West, let's say.
Or maybe a fault line somewhere.
Right.
Well, Brooke, thank you so much.
Faithful.
Yeah, there we go. I really appreciate you giving us the insight into this suit. And to sum up, let me ask you, do you think it's going to be pursued?
I'm hopeful. Reading the response from the Becks, and I have not spoken to them personally since the order for dismissal came down. It looks like they're ready to go that direction, and I do need to give Elizabeth a call and find out what's entailed kind of behind the scenes, because the sense that I get is that this might be a little bit easier of a lift for them by like just getting this definition is for whatever reason it seems a little less daunting to them as they're talking about it in the media than moving towards discovery in a case where there were some unexplained deaths along the way. So they seemed a little bit more upbeat about filing for the appeal. Again, 21 days, and if they decide to do it, they probably won't go up to the last minute. So I would say in the next two weeks, we will likely know whether or not that's going to go to appeal.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Brooke. I really appreciate it. And I'm sorry you can't join us Sunday, but I know you'll be with us in spirit.
I will.
Okay. Thanks again, Brooke. You take care.
Okay. Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Well, next up, we have got the amazing Professor Wendy Lin Lee, who you know has been with us before, and she's going to weigh in on some of the current matters before us. And without any further ado, Professor Wendy Lin Lee.
Luckily for us as journalists and philosophers, things are going so well here in the Representative Republic that there's very little to talk about.
Right. Yeah, I thought maybe we'd just discuss gardening and my success in growing corn this year.
Well, there you go. And how are your birds?
They're all fine. They're right here. One is on my shoulder. That scratchy noise you hear is actually a ferret making a gigantic mess in the habitat that I just finished cleaning.
That all being said, let's go on to a few things. There's so much to dislike and be concerned about with the Trump administration's agenda.
Yeah.
Let me just ask your top few of the hit list of things that trouble you about the Trump agenda. What would be the first couple off top of your head?
Oh, there's so many to choose from. I think at the very top of my top 10 hits list is probably still withdrawal from Paris. From the Paris Climate Accord,
Sure.
And followed right after by what I gather is going to be his decision about DACA, which I find cruel, irrelevant, and just particularly tone deaf, cruel, given what's going on in Houston. You don't make decisions that do direct harm to people who are innocent, and you particularly ought not to make decisions that do them such immense harm in the middle of a catastrophe in a state that is the residence of so many of the people affected by that horrendous decision.
And speaking of visiting a state and offering a horrendous decision, how about the pardoning of Sheriff Arpaio? A real fighter for anti-justice, if there ever was one.
Yeah, and I've seen a number of different commentaries about that. I think the one I find the most persuasive is that this was a message sent to Trump loyalists. Right. If you fall in line, if you fall on a sword for me, right, if you do my bidding, I will pardon you. But if you don't, right, there's the other side of that, of course. If you don't, then, you know, I might let you hang in the wind. But it was an appalling decision. The timing was particularly appalling and charlatan. Every day I send a tweet to Mr. Trump telling him how ugly his decisions have already been for that day.
You know, in the mountain of terrible environmental decisions and directions, this killing of the flood insurance before the hurricane season was really even underway. I understand that that Trump's 30% will be with him if literally he marched them himself to the death chamber. This has got to be increasingly obvious, even to the most rightward tilting middle of the roader. I mean, this is just one more of an appalling series of decisions that are so against American grain as we used to think of it.
Yeah. It defies reason, and yet it's just one more decision that defies reason speaking of flooding and just a flood, 8 months of an absolute deluge of decisions that defy reason. I mean, I am not queen of the world, but if I were, I would declare Houston, or at least most of Houston, an irrecoverable disaster zone, just as I would have after Hurricane Katrina. And I would have ensured that people could move and could move their lives out of a region that is region of the United States that is simply no longer viable. In the literature, this is called strategic abandonment. I think the same actually about Coney Island. There will be, and it will be more violent, and it will be more catastrophic. There will be another hurricane, right? We have Irma sitting not at what, about 1,000 miles potentially off the coast of Florida right now.
Yeah.
These storms will get more catastrophic. These will become worse and worse and more frequent. And the idea of rebuilding in the same locations after these storms have devastated entire neighborhoods is truly ludicrous. And so there is no dollar amount that you can put on that. People have to be able to simply leave with their jobs, with their families, with their children, and be relocated in honorable ways outside of these flood zones, right? And it goes without saying that the people here who are the most damaged, most impacted, just like they were for Sandy, just like they were for Katrina, are the most vulnerable, the poorest, the least able, the least likely to have flood insurance in the first place, and the least able to rebuild.
And the other thing, as a person who's been attentive to environmental concerns like yourself, you can't help but see, when you see all that flooding combined with what has been basically uncontrolled growth, unregulated chemical companies and their related industries, the long-term environmental impact to these communities is monstrous. There's no nicer way to put it.
So it's incalculable. And it will both be incalculable and it will be utterly uncompensated, because it is so difficult to prove, to show any direct line, even vaguely direct line, between the chemical toxification of an environment and the illnesses that ultimately accrue to it. It's incredibly difficult to show that. And corporations who can far and away outgun private citizens with respect to their legal representations virtually always win. So the people who are most impacted, even when they think that they've reasonably recovered, that they've reasonably restored their lives, maybe it'll be 10 years or 20 or 30 years down the road, but the potential toxic effects of chemical release and the combinatorial effects of those chemicals released and then becoming more toxic in combination with one another, they just won't know what made them sick.
And unfortunately, it seems the way our justice system works, although it's quite easy to confiscate goods and services from the poor, that never seems to happen for corporate leaders, does it?
Yeah. No, it's just not set up that way. And, what we'll discover here, just like we discovered with Katrina, just like we discovered with Sandy, just like we discovered with Andrew, is that the people who will recover the most swiftly and the best and will be able to return to the business of fleecing all the rest of us as usual will be the hydrocarbon companies. Indeed, they're making money off this even now, right, through price gouging. Gas here in rural Pennsylvania went up 30 cents yesterday all at once. Right, so, they won't let this tragedy go to waste. The gas companies, the gas and oil companies, the chemical companies, they'll take a short term loss, but they will ultimately be in a position for long term gain, and we all know it.
Yeah. Another area of great concern for me, again, it's hard to pick and choose the bleakest spots for the Trump administration, but I have to say that. Troubling for its long-term impact is the persistent attacks on the press. I understand that as a strategy to obscure, obfuscate, point the finger at somebody else, it's a standard tool of the fascists to blame the press and try to cover up their misdeeds. But unfortunately, I'm not so sure. You hear stories now where members of the press are being attacked by the public at large simply for being members of the press before they can even report. So essentially, if we end up with a reporter-free zone surrounding this regime, we're in for some very, very dangerous times.
Yeah, there's a bill. This is at least indirectly related. There's a bill in front of the Pennsylvania State House that would make any protester arrested, and I mean arrested for, say, an act of civil disobedience, say simply refusing to move, protesters, say, locked arms in front of the Capitol building, or protesters who exited the notoriously unconstitutional free speech zones. There's a bill before the State House that would make them economically liable to pay all of the costs of their arrest. This, of course, will have an incredibly, if it passes, an incredibly chilling effect on protests, even if it meets constitutional challenge, right, for the time being, it could really chill protests. And that, too, I think, is related to this attack on the press, because it makes news, it makes the dissemination of fact more and more and more and more difficult. The more the Trump administration can move us to distrust the news, the more protesters are intimidated into silence. The less we see, and the more we could be convinced of this sort of new normal where we go about our lives without any access to any real facts or real news until something just horrific happens, right? Like we find out later that we've bombed North Korea and that, you know, millions and millions of South Koreans in Seoul are dead. And we'll see that even as a sanitized news clip. That seems clear that that's as they would have it if we allow this to happen.
You know, another thing that concerns me greatly, you know, the commercialization of the military. It seems that Eric Prince is having no trouble getting major ink in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times as he advocates for the commercialization of the next phase of the ongoing persistent wars in Afghanistan, at least overtly. Mm-hmm. How is it, you think, that a character like that, who's clearly serving nothing beyond his own economic interests, and he can get placement in journals of such import in our national dialogue?
I don't actually think that's terribly difficult to answer. This is the Wall Street Journal. I respect the Wall Street Journal, but he is advocating an economic enterprise. And from the point of view of capitalism, ideologically at least, the substance of the enterprise is not what's relevant. The moral defensibility of the enterprise is not what's directly relevant. What's relevant is the profitability of the enterprise, as if profitability were its own gauge of its ethical worth. So, you know, Prince is just offering up one more profit-making enterprise that's, I think, from the point of view of at least some of the Wall Street Journal, not substantively different from a real estate enterprise, a golf course, a hotel, the privatization of prisons, the privatization of the public school system in New Orleans, right? Where our sole measure of value is profitability, this is simply an extension of the ideology that we have already bought lock, stock, and barrel.
You know, it is mind-blowing to me. You know, the Wall Street, I completely agree with you regarding the Wall Street Journal. I occasionally allow myself hope with the New York Times. Self-serving, self-interest, not to mention the depravity of helping this nation by blowing it up. It's appalling beyond words, it really is.
Yeah, and when you combine that with having an infant, a psychopathic infant at the helm who you fear his finger on the button on the red button of a nuclear holocaust is the same finger on the same hand that he is utterly unable to control with respect to his Twitter. That it's just an incredibly fearful state of affairs. I don't know. I can't understand how it is that he can retain even 30% of people, other than that they are, I gather, so convinced that the news is the enemy of the state that they really just don't read it at all. And they're just waiting for some mythical event to come about that improves their lives. I don't know what it will take to convince them that world is not going to transpire for them. The wall is not going to be built. Right, climate change is going to proceed apace. They are not going to have health insurance. Their children are not going to be educated. Right, they are not going to have access to cancer drugs. Right, their environments are going to be despoiled. What does it take? It baffles me.
Well, speaking of uncomprehending, Florida was visited by the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos.
Sister of Eric.
And she managed to completely avoid public schools, visited charter school, visited a religious school. And, you know, when called to task on this, obviously public schools are irrelevant to this particular administration's education leadership. There's really only one conclusion you can draw from that kind of thinking, that it is best if we have a larger and larger, increasingly ignorant and illiterate population. You really can't draw any other conclusion.
I agree. I think the only alteration I would make in that is I think that this administration is actually very interested in education. They're very interested in gutting education. They're very interested in grossly misinformed education, right? She would teach creationism, right? They would certainly fail to teach any of the science that would lead a thinking person to the facts about climate change, the facts about disease vectors, facts about Ebola, facts about any number of things that are going to nuclear waste that are going to do us in, because ignorance is sadly, right, and I say this with a certain like pain in my gut, ignorance is what brought this man to power. Ignorance is what brings many in his cabinet to their positions. Ignorance, boredom, and increasingly inculcated, instilled, enculturated paranoia. That's what could keep him in power. That's what ends even this pretense of an experiment called democracy.
Well, we've dredged the Trumpian swamp long enough. I need to bring up at least two positive notes. I thought that it was the most exquisite poetic touch when Mexico sent people to help Texas and Venezuela.
Yeah.
Did as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that I saw that. We haven't actually seen a tremendous lot of press coverage of that. I really wish that we had seen more, but I did see something. And yet, you know, if you go to websites like Town Hall or Breitbart, you go to the alt-right websites, what you see is not that. But, and I just find it ironic and disturbing, a promotion of a number of what I regard as right-wing hate groups, who have also gone to, you know, put in their aid, do their part by the victims of Hurricane Harvey. Right? And it's not that I begrudge anyone who's willing to help out, but I just find it ironic that some of the same people that we might well have seen marching among those nice Klansmen in Charlottesville, you know, are now helping out with Hurricane Harvey, right? But we would be fools if we thought anything other than that this is the same opportunity that they take as the one that Trump takes to use a tragedy in order to promote their credentials as humane, as the kind of group you want to join.
Let me ask you to weigh in on another issue that I think is going to become, I think, the news story of September. Trump has gone out of his way to savage most of Republican leadership. Now he's actually depended on them for a budget, for tax legislation, maybe one more swing at health care. And, of course, to defend him, Should somewhere there be the nerve to call him to task and impeachment charges be laid? What do you say to a guy who's basically savaged all his friends?
I say, wow, aren't you a lucky guy that all of your alleged friends are gutless and are concerned far more with their reelectability than with anything that resembles even a shred of personal integrity, right? They're simply gutless. If we've learned anything over the last several months, especially around healthcare and tax reform, it's that there's virtually no quantity of flogging or invitation to self-flagellation that the Republican Party won't lower itself to in order to be reelected come midterm or even in 4 years. These are mice. They're gutless. That's what we've learned. They're gutless. They will do anything. They will say anything. They will kiss any hiney presented to them in the interest of ensuring their own electability, because they fear that some small population of that 30% are in their districts.
And speaking of gutless, my God, the rousing defense of liberty from the Democratic Party has been awe-inspiring.
You and I must be living on two different planets.
I have to admit to indulging in a little sarcasm, truth be told.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen a very unified message. I haven't seen, but then again, I don't find this particularly
surprising.
This is not any different, I think, than what we saw during the 2016 campaign cycle. If there are gutless Republicans who keep their seats at the midterm elections, it will be at least partly on the Democrats that they managed to do that, because the Democrats didn't run any campaign or any really viable, inspiring candidates against them.
Yeah, I know the one thing I heard from Chuck, besides, you know, send money, was that Mr. Schumer thought that he could get along with the Republican budget. He can work with them. And I thought that for a message coming from the opposition party, it wasn't even pathetic.
Yeah, it's not surprising. It's not particularly newsworthy. It is politic on Schumer's part, which simply aligns him with it's politic on the part of Ryan. Is there really any bright line, red line between them? No, not really. Not really.
Well, Professor, thank you so very much. I really appreciate, especially in these days and times, to hear the voice of someone intelligent and thoughtful on these matters, because the amount of quailing and quivering before the Trumpian machine is just it's saddening. So thank you so much.
My model is that young man standing in Tiananmen Square in front of the tanks. I'm not that, but that's what I aspire to be.
That's a beautiful thought. Thank you, my dear. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it. Our special report today on the...
Luckily for us as a journal...
So we've enjoyed Brooke, and then we've also had the pleasure of hearing from Professor Wendy Lin Lee. Let me leave you with a little message from Progressive News Network, and we'll call it a day for now. So thanks so much for joining us, and I hope you'll come back again and join us on Sunday when we have our Progressive Roundtable.
Progressive News Network, a new Mercury Media production, where you'll find the voices of activists, the voices of those working to make this a better world. We believe that as we face challenging times, the human spirit can face and surmount the foolish and the short-sighted. Tune in every Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, for the live show, or anytime you can. Progressive News Network, found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. We have a future. Tune in and build it with us. Underwritten by Florida Media Labs, produced by Rick Spivak in cooperation with Canary and a Coal Mine Films. Progressive News Network.
Bye-bye.